Good morning.
We're on lesson three of our class on Revelation. We're still in the introduction. We will still be in the introduction on lesson four. But next week we will get to verse one, I promise. We're still on the set of handouts I passed out for lesson one, so we have not had a new handout since the first lesson. If you have not been here before, you can get the handouts from our website, thywordistruth.com. Also, you can get audio copies of each lesson and the notes from which I am teaching each lesson. Let's start our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we thank you for this time when we can meet together and study your word. Father, we are so thankful for your word, for the truth that you have given us, and for the truth that by which we can be saved. Father, we are especially thankful today for this wonderful book of Revelation. We pray that as we read it and as we study it, we will understand and know about the danger of compromise and about the importance of remaining loyal and faithful and true to you till death. And Father, we pray these things in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. Last week, we ended by looking at Rome and Greece. And particularly, we were looking at the importance that Rome played in the plans of God, as God prepared the world for His Son and for the eternal kingdom that was to replace the kingdoms of this earth. Daniel 2, in fact, tells us about four kingdoms that would rule in the 600 years between his time and the time of Christ. And the history of those four great empires was determined once Daniel set down his prophecy and God told Daniel what would happen in that time. And history also confirms that. History shows us the hand of God working in those empires. How else, for example, can we explain the rise of Greece under Alexander the Great? How else, for example, can we explain the ascendancy of Rome over such great powers as Carthage and the Hellenistic kingdoms? How else can we explain the triumph of the church over the great empires of the earth? Rome attacked and persecuted the church when the church was in its infancy and Rome was at its height. And yet Rome failed and the church triumphed. How else can we explain these things except for the hand of God? I mentioned last week that if you want a faith-building exercise, you should get a history of Rome, a secular history of Rome, and read and see what they say, secular historians say, about this very point. Here's one, Rome and Her Enemies. I bought this just a few weeks ago. It's not a religious book at all. It's a secular history of Rome. I turn to the introduction, and I read, "Lying at its heart is a mystery as profound as any in the records of human civilization. How on earth did the Romans do it? How did a single city, one that began as a small community of cattle rustlers, camped out among marshes and hills, end up ruling an empire that stretched from the moors of Scotland to the deserts of Iraq? How did they do it? Because God had said they would rule the earth at the time of Christ. That's how they did it." It's also interesting to study the interplay of Greek and Roman culture at this time. I think I mentioned last time the famous statement by Horace that Rome may have conquered Greece, but Greek culture conquered Rome. The combination of Greek culture and Roman might and power created the perfect cradle for the coming of Christ and the beginning and establishment of His kingdom. These things did not happen by accident. The Greeks, they brought reason. They brought rationality. They brought logic. They brought language. The Romans, they brought peace. They brought roads. They brought trade. They brought law. They brought communication. It's the combination of these things that created the perfect time for Christ to come into this world. Now, we're going to be talking about the Roman state religion of Caesar worship. We've already had a lot to say about that and about the great persecution that came as a result of that. But that was a late development. Early on, before that really took off, Roman religion was open and tolerant. In fact, even after Caesar worship took off, Rome saw itself as open and tolerant. Because you could worship anything and anyone as long as you also worshiped Caesar. But that openness and that tolerance allowed new religions, allowed new ideas to be spread more easily. And as we know, Paul certainly took advantage of that in speaking to many crowds and in many opportunities. The importance of the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, that cannot be overstated. What if Rome had never come? What if we just had the Greeks? I mean, they had the language, right? So maybe we just had... No. The Greeks' hobby was war. The Greek states waged war against each other constantly. Can you imagine trying to spread the gospel in that kind of a situation where wars are constantly raging? Rome came in and swept all of that away. And at the time the gospel was being spread, there was a time of peace across the known world. Again, not by accident. Another important factor I've mentioned was the Greek language. You'll notice that even after Rome conquered the Greeks, the known world did not speak Latin. Latin hardly ever got out of the city of Rome. The known world still spoke Greek. Greek had been around, the Greek language, since 800 BC when Daniel was writing his prophecies. There was already Greek language. Greek has twice the vocabulary of Latin. Greek, as we know, is the language in which the Gospel, the New Testament, was written. You know, those who believe, and there are many of them today that will tell you this, that Christianity is anti-intellectual, that Christianity is irrational, they should note that Christianity began at a time of Greek intellectualism and Greek rationalism. And again, that was no accident. That is when God set down the church. That is when Christ came into this world. At a time when Greek culture and Greek rationality and Greek logic was at its height. God could have set him down at a time of great superstition, for example. He did not. And that's an important point for us to remember, that he started the church, he spread the gospel initially at a time when people were beginning to focus on rational inquiry. And we see that in Acts and in the Gospels. Even today, Greek logic and Greek thought still pervades our culture 2,000 years later. You know, it's been said that the Greek contribution to Western philosophy was Western philosophy. I mean, much of it still goes back to the Greek times, that time at which the church started. These things are not by accident. Our next question, and you know, for those that still have the handout from the first class, we're still working down through our list of introductory questions. And our next question is, who were the emperors of Rome and why should we care? We've already looked at some of the emperors of Rome. Earlier lesson, we looked at them. And we're going to spend a lot more time talking about some of the emperors of Rome. Who were they and why should we care? Well, we should care because Daniel cared 600 years before the fact. And we should care because John cared as he wrote this book. And the Holy Spirit, of course, inspiring both Daniel and John, cared as the Holy Spirit conveyed these words regarding the Roman emperors. Daniel sketched out a history of the first 11 Roman emperors 600 years before they came to power. John described them while they were in power. We're going to need to understand that historical context to really understand the book of Revelation. Our focus, as I've mentioned before, will be on the first 11 emperors. They're listed on the colorful handout that's hard to read, that I hope you still have. If not, it's available on the internet, thywordistruth.com. Now, when I say the first 11 emperors, that in itself creates a bit of a controversy because it's unclear where we start counting. Now, there's a big issue. Do we start with Julius Caesar or do we start with his successor, Augustus? Most historians will tell you Augustus was the first Roman emperor. Julius Caesar, as you know, was killed by those who feared that he was trying to set up a monarchy. And his death in 44 BC really marked the end of the Roman Republic and the beginning of the Roman Empire. But if we're just counting out Roman kings, we'd have to start a lot earlier. Because I mentioned before that Rome was in fact a monarchy before it became a republic. And then later again became a monarchy or an empire. So I'm going to start counting with Augustus as we look through this book. And it's not just because modern historians tell me he's the first emperor. It's because he fits with what we're going to read in this book. I think we need to start with Augustus. I think it also makes sense historically, because Augustus, in fact, was the first emperor. Also, Augustus was the emperor when Christ came into the world. He was the one ruling the Roman Empire. I think that's another reason to start with Augustus. Augustus, then, I believe, was the first emperor. Although, interestingly, no one at the time would have ever called him that. It had not grown to the point that the Romans themselves recognized that he was an emperor. But, in fact, he was the first emperor. His stepson, Tiberius, was the second. Tiberius' adopted grandson, Caligula, came next. Claudius, Caligula's uncle. And then Nero, stepson of Claudius. The first five make up the Julio-Claudian dynasty. They're a group. They're a dynasty. The next three we've mentioned all came and died in a very short period of time during the Roman civil wars of 68-69. Galba reigned 7 months and then was hacked to pieces in the forum. Otho reigned 95 days, then killed himself when Vitellius entered the city. Vitellius reigned 8 months and then was killed after Vespasian entered the city. Those three came and went in a very quick period of time. Then we get the next big dynasty, the Flavian dynasty. Vespasian, who along with his son Titus, destroyed the temple in Rome in the city of Jerusalem. Titus was Vespasian's eldest son. He reigned next, but he reigned only a short time, 26 months. And then came Domitian, his younger brother. When Domitian died, that Flavian dynasty also died with it. Following that second dynasty, there was a period of relatively good emperors, starting with Nerva. We're going to see that this history, these emperors, fit like a puzzle into this book, as they do into Daniel. Daniel 7, Revelation 17, where we'll really get involved with these emperors. The next question is, how and when did Rome fall? Well, that's a very big question. In our studies of Revelation, I'm going to be arguing that its judgments, the judgments in that book, are largely directed toward Rome. Rome was the one who was persecuting the Lord's church at that time. I think Rome is the focus of Revelation. That argument, though, is going to present us with some important questions we're going to have to deal with. When did the Roman Empire fall? How did the Roman Empire fall? What factors contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire? How was that fall a divine judgment by God? And did the fact that Christianity, I'll put that in quotes, had become the official state religion at the time of its fall mean that the enmity between the Roman Empire and God had ended by that time? It's a lot of questions. As I mentioned, the imperial period of ancient Roman history began in 27 BC when Augustus came to power. It ended in A.D. 476, when the city fell and was overthrown. But the Roman Empire itself continued on for another 1,000 years, just not in the West, continued in the East for another 1,000 years until it was finally sacked by the Ottoman Turks in the 15th century. So how do we fit in a judgment by God against Rome into that historical sequence of events? Well, let's first look and see what factors are attributed to the fall of Rome. I'll tell you, one of the books in my library is a book entitled The Fall of Rome. And it goes through and lists all the various reasons that historians have put forward for the fall of Rome. And there's something like 300 or 400 in that one book as to the fall of Rome. Things such as rats and things such as the lead in their drinking containers, driving them crazy, all sorts of various ideas. But I'll turn to Gibbon, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, classic treatise on the topic, and he points to 4 primary reasons for the fall of Rome. External invasion, well, we all know about that one. Inner decadence, inner strife, and just the injury of time and nature. Well, let's turn to another expert on the fall of Rome. The prophet Daniel. Daniel chapter 2, where he talks about that kingdom of iron that will rule the world. Well, he also talks about the weakness of that kingdom in Daniel chapter 2. And as you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. Yes, Rome was a kingdom of iron, but Rome was also a kingdom of clay. That description from Daniel 2 fits pretty well what we just saw from Gibbon about the reasons for Rome's fall. In any event, if Rome is indeed the villain of this book, then it's clear that this villain, which would then be Rome, was judged by God. How and when did that judgment occur? Well, one theory is that Rome was judged when the Western Empire fell and the city was invaded in AD 476. Now, a potential problem with that is that that is some time away from the point in time in which we're now looking in the first century. So one might argue that that causes some concern for our time frame that we've talked about. Another possible concern there is that we hear a lot about the fall of Rome, the fall of Rome. Well, historians tell us that when the city fell in 476, it wasn't looked on at the time as much of a fall. There wasn't a whole lot of change in the average citizen's daily life at that time when the city fell. And in fact, the Eastern Empire continued on for another 1,000 years. Another theory is that when Nero died, as we know, his dynasty ended. And when Domitian died, his dynasty ended. So we had two great persecuting dynasties of emperors in the first century. And yes, they did fall. Yes, they were judged in the first century. So it's possible that these judgments are directed more toward the emperors, toward their dynasties at this time. Another possibility. And in fact, the emperors that followed Domitian, that came along after these dynasties, were very, very different from the former emperors. Gibbon, again quoting Gibbon, he says, "If a man were called to fix the period of history of the world when the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would without hesitation name that period which elapsed after the death of Domitian, about the next 100 years. That's quite a change. It's possible that the focus of the judgments in these books are directed less toward Rome the empire and more toward Rome the emperors, particularly those first two dynasties that persecuted the church so severely. First one culminating in Nero, the second one culminating in Domitian. But didn't Rome convert to Christianity? Now, I took a history course. I seem to recall that somewhere along the line, Rome had a big conversion and it became a Christian empire. How could that possibly be a judgment by God? Well, it certainly appears to some that Christianity conquered Rome in the sense that Rome converted to Christianity under the Emperor Constantine. And many historians argue that. But is that really what happened? In order to answer that question, we need to look briefly at the life of Constantine and about his supposed conversion and determine whether, in fact, he was a great champion of the church or was he, in fact, something else. Constantine was born in AD 285 and came to power through a bunch of civil wars. At this point, he had a primary concern after civil war. That was to unify the empire. That was what he needed to do. And he embraced Christianity to do that as a unifying force. He staked everything on it and began to use it for his own purposes. Was his conversion genuine? Well, that question has long been a subject of debate and speculation. Michael Grant, who's written a lot of very interesting histories of this time, had the following to say about Constantine's motivations. "The emperor's motives have been endlessly analyzed and discussed, but it appears that he and his advisors experienced a growing conviction that however uninfluential the Christians might be at present, the course of events was working or could be made to work in their favor, since they alone possessed the universal aims, an efficient, coherent organization that in the long run could unite the various conflicting peoples and classes of people into a single all-embracing harmony, which was Catholic, that is, universal. So we see here a politician exploiting Christianity for his own personal gain and advancement. Well, we've never seen that before, have we? Constantine was just the first in a long line of politicians to do that very thing. Constantine did end the persecution of the church. He also began to treat Christianity as a state religion, which it later became. He also authorized money for building elaborate church buildings. It all started at that time. But his own personal lack of conviction is evidenced by the fact that he had his own son put to death, and he had his wife put to death, and he retained his own position as the chief priest at the pagan temples. He was just using Christianity for his own personal benefit. Ramsay MacMullen says, "Few of the essential elements of Christian belief interested Constantine very much. Neither God's mercy nor man's sinfulness, neither damnation nor salvation, neither brotherly love, needless to say, humility. Ardent in his convictions, he remained nevertheless oblivious to their moral implications." You know, I've heard it said that some people's religion is so private they don't even impose it on themselves. And in fact, I think we see here an example of that. Constantine was using Christianity, yet he saw no obligation to follow it himself. And again, I think we see some modern-day counterparts. There are many modern-day Constantines. Now, Alistair Key has written the best book on this subject, Constantine versus Christ. And he described Constantine's attitude toward religion as follows. He said, "It played an important part in his ambition to conquer and unify the empire. Religion was too important to his strategy to leave in the hands of the ecclesiastics." In other words, don't leave it to the church. I need to use it for my own personal benefit. And he took it over. Was he a positive influence on the church? Well, Alistair Key, who probably knows nothing about the Lord's church, here's what he says about whether Constantine at that time was a positive influence on the church of that time. "Because of his relationship to the church, Constantine was able to influence it and Christianity to a profound level. We must now consider how Constantine's values infiltrated the church. Not how he was converted to Christianity, but how through his religious policy he succeeded in converting Christianity to his position." Key states that the values of Christianity were taken over by the values of Constantine. They were replaced. Christianity was enlisted in Constantine's own personal crusade to gain control of the empire. And by that process, he says, Christianity was transformed. The Roman Empire's embrace of Christianity did more to damage the church than its earlier persecution. Persecution, in a sense, allowed the church to remain pure. You know, I'd like to think we'd all still be here, and I hope we all would, but maybe we wouldn't all still be here this morning if we were under threat of death, if we were caught. 2 Corinthians 12:10, Paul talks about his weakness, his insults, his hardships, his persecutions, and he says, "When I am weak, then I am strong." Alistair Key, again, mirrors this. And I've got a few longer quotes than I usually give today, but some of these quotes are just so good, I want to give them to you here, particularly these from Key. There's a later quote from him where he nails it. Here's one. "Only a sadist would wish that persecution continue in the church. Only a masochist welcome it. And yet suffering seemed an inescapable experience for early Christians. The history of the church till the 4th century was of random and often intensive persecution. Whenever the emperor or the traditions of the empire seemed threatened, it was open season on persecuting Christians. And yet this tiny minority, insignificant, weak, and defenseless, not only survived, but grew. To Christians, it was not at all incredible that persecution could actually strengthen the church. It brought precisely the experience in which God was made known to them in strength. The verse I just read to you. The later Roman influence effectively weakened the church from within, he writes. That's always the effect that society has on the church when society comes into the church. When we let the world into the church and start letting the world change us rather than us changing the world, this will be the effect. It will weaken us from within. What happened under this embrace of Christianity? There was rapid growth. Growth like they'd never seen before. Suddenly it was fashionable to be a Christian. Suddenly there were wonderful buildings where they could all gather. Tremendous growth. But what came with that growth? A weakening. A weakening from within. Maddox describes Constantine's influence this way. Out of respect to Constantine for the favors he showed, the church gave up her independence and began to rely upon the head of the state for its organization and its authority. The leader seemed too concerned with present problems to see the danger in these developments. Key. Why it had been previously thought that Constantine was Christian is not because what he believed was Christian, but because what he believed came to be called Christian. Finally, this quote from Key that is a sobering lesson in the danger of compromise. Key tells us that the church of Constantine's day, in embracing Rome, rejected Christ. Did Rome become more like the church, or did the church of that day become more like Rome? Well, why don't you ask a Roman Catholic? After commenting upon this strength that the Christians had obtained through their persecutions, here's what Key says. It is therefore all the more tragic that Christians should, in the moment of victory, forsake the revelation in Jesus for its opposite in Constantine. The church did not need the protection of Constantine. It had already taken on the empire century after century and had in the end been victorious. If Constantine had in turn persecuted the church, he too would have failed to conquer it. How was it then that he was able to succeed where his predecessors had failed? How was it that by a little kindness, a word of praise here, a grant to build a new church there, he was able to induce the church to forsake what they could not be made to forsake under threat of torture or death? The emperor offered so much beyond the dreams of Christians recently under constant threat. He offered in effect at least a share in the kingdoms of this world. When Satan is seen to offer such rewards, the temptation is rejected. When one comes professing to be a follower of the one God, then his offer is accepted. And once again, the Son of Man was betrayed by a kiss. Note that the betrayal took place in a moment. It did not take place in a moment. It was a gradual process. Gradually, the church came to have faith in the emperor, to trust him, and to see in him and in his ways the hand of God. That is sobering. Scott.
Samuel's time is wanting a king to be more like the nations around him. And this particular point that you're making here, because I see a parallel there. It's very interesting.
I agree. It's an excellent parallel. I have not seen it, but that would make a very good lesson. Sobering statements and relevant statements to us today, because politicians court us constantly. The hand of man or the hand of God. Final big topic. How should we approach Revelation? Well, there are a lot of different ways to approach this book. I'm going to look at a number of them. One, it's very popular, is called the historical approach. It's sometimes called the standard Protestant interpretation. It's taken, for example, in the Gospel Advocate series of commentaries, the one on Revelation written by Hines. This approach views the book as a forecast and symbols of the history of man from the time of the establishment of the church leading up until the end of time. Each point in history can be somehow mapped to something in the book of Revelation. The Roman Catholic Church often plays a very major role in the historical approach. They're often the villain in this book. And it's certainly true that the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman Empire have much in common. Will Durant, I'm sure you've heard of him, a pretty famous historian, he has a very interesting comparison of the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman Empire. And this is my second and final lengthy quote of the day, but I want to read to you what Will Durant has to say about the comparison between those two. Christianity grew by the absorption. When Will Durant's talking about Christianity, he's talking about the Roman Catholic Church. Grew by the absorption of pagan faith and ritual. It became a triumphant church by inheriting the organizing patterns and genius of Rome. As Judea had given Christianity ethics and Greece had given it theology, according to Durant, so now Rome gave it organization. All these, with a dozen absorbed and rival faiths, entered into the Christian synthesis. It was not merely that the church took over some religious customs and forms. The vestments and the soul of the pagan priest, for example, entered the Roman Catholic Church. The use of incense, holy water, and purifications entered into the Roman Catholic Church. The burning of candles and an everlasting light before the altar into the Roman Catholic Church. The worship of the saints, the architecture of the basilica, the law of Rome as a basis for canon law, the title of the Pontifex Maximus for the supreme pontiff. In the 4th century, the Latin language. These all came from the Roman Empire into the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman gift was above all a vast framework of government. Durant is saying it's not just the name of the pontiff. It's not just the use of incense. It's something even more, it's bigger than that. Durant's saying it's the organization. The Roman gift was above all a vast framework of government, which as secular authority failed became the structure of ecclesiastical rule. What was in the Roman Empire is their organization began to go into this Roman Catholic Church that was developing. Soon the bishops, rather than the Roman prefects, would be the source of order and the seat of power. The metropolitans or archbishops would support, if not supplant, the provincial governors of Rome. The synod of bishops would succeed the provincial assembly. The Roman Catholic Church followed the footsteps of the Roman state. It conquered the provinces, beautified the capital, established discipline. Rome died giving birth to the Roman Catholic Church. That's the relation between the two. Why do I point out that close relationship here? It's because in the historical approach, the Roman Catholic Church is seen as the villain. And the point is made, well, look at the symbols in the book. They fit the Roman Catholic Church so well. They do. But the reason they do is because they first fit Rome well. And what was Rome became the Roman Catholic Church. So just because the symbols in the book fit the Roman Catholic Church well does not mean that's what it's talking about. I think what it's actually talking about is what gave the Roman Catholic Church that structure. And that's the Roman Empire of the first century. Now, a major problem with this historical view, in my opinion, is that it operates under kind of an unstated assumption. And that is that we are living in the last times. If I hand you the book of Revelation, and I trace its history from the first chapter to the last chapter, and in the last chapter we end up in the 20th century, then, I mean, I'm stating here by doing that, that's the end of the time. We're living in the last times. I'm able to stretch history through the book from then to now with no chapters left over. How do we know we're living in the last times? How do we know that this earth will not be here another million years? Now you say, well, that seems a little extreme. How do we know that? We do not know when Christ will come again. I do not know if the history from the first century to the end of time will be 2,000 years, will be 10,000 years, will be 50,000. I don't know. So that makes it very hard for me to describe history from one end to the next when I don't know the final end. There will be no signs of the end. It will come as a thief in the night. Any theory that's based on an assumption that we can know when the end will happen, or that we can know that we are living in the end times, is based on a wrong assumption. It's deeply flawed. This view also, I think, ignores John's time frame for the book. We've already talked about that. At the beginning of the book, at the end of the book, John says these things are about to happen. The historical approach also makes the book of little significance to its initial readers. I've also talked about that. It's so important that however we read this book, we understand it from the eyes of a first century Christian who is being so severely persecuted by Nero, by Rome, by Domitian. If it has no significance to them, if our interpretation of it would have no significance to them, then our interpretation is wrong. This historical view also suffers from what I called the Nostradamus effect before, where you take some statement about what might happen or will happen, and then you kind of slide it along history until you get a match, and then aha, that's what it is. Well, that's what happens in these historical commentaries. They've got about 2,000 years to work with, and they take an event in Rome and they slide it along. Well, that must be this one right here, and they set it down. Ignores the time frame. Well, let's go to the opposite end. That was historical. You can probably tell I reject that. Let's go to the futurist approach. The futurist approach claims that nothing in the book of Revelation from chapter 4 until the end has yet been fulfilled. Instead, the entire book will be fulfilled at some time what they call the second coming of Christ, the end of the world. This is also often referred to as the dispensationalist approach. And I am lumping a few various approaches together under this futurist heading. But here is kind of a brief overview of the dispensationalist view, the futurist view. They say Jesus came to establish a visible rule on earth. That was his goal. The Jews did not accept Christ, and so that offer was withdrawn. The establishment of the kingdom, according to them, was postponed until his return. In the meantime, the church was established. Kind of an interim period, a parenthesis in history, they say. Kind of a mistake. They always downplay the importance of the church. The church age, they say, will end in a rapture, which all believers will meet Christ in the air. This is the first stage of the second advent, they say. During the next 7 years, the Antichrist will rule the earth. The Jews will be restored to Palestine. The temple will be rebuilt. The sacrificial system will be reinstituted. Those saved during this time will be called tribulation saints. The Antichrist will break a covenant with the Jews after 3.5 years, and a terrible persecution will follow. After another 3.5 years, Christ will appear a third time, defeat the Antichrist, and rule on earth for 1,000 years. I also reject that view. Hal Lindsey is even more imaginative. Here's his sequence of events from his original proclamation back in the 70s. For 3.5 years, Satan will rule the world through a Jewish Antichrist in Rome. The Jews will be allowed to rebuild the temple. Many Jews will be converted. A worldwide evangelism program will be undertaken by 144,000 Jewish preachers. After 3.5 years, the Antichrist will set up his own image in the newly rebuilt Jewish temple. World War III will break out. Egypt will invade Israel. Russia will invade the Middle East and trample both Egypt and Israel. The Roman dictator will invade Israel. Rome will launch a nuclear attack against Russian forces in Israel. 200 million Chinese troops will march on Palestine to battle the Roman army. The Battle of Armageddon will begin and lead to worldwide destruction. Jesus will return to reign on earth for 1,000 years. The late, great planet Earth. If some of Hal's ideas seem a little dated, he noticed that too. And he's now come out with a few additional books to give some updated views on what he says will happen. You know, time will not allow us to go through everything that's wrong with that. Of course it ignores the time frame. Of course, it makes the book of no significance to its original readers. It changes as quickly as the headlines. Many thought Hitler was the Antichrist. Some still do. Many saw Gorbachev as the Antichrist. He even came with a built-in mark of the beast. More recently, Saddam Hussein was the Antichrist. You know, when I was teaching this before in Dallas, they interviewed a local dispensationalist preacher there in Dallas. Dallas is full of them. And they interviewed one who had said some things and he had to retract them because it just hadn't turned out the way he said it was going to happen. And he said he wasn't worried at all because everything he had said was biblical. Everything he had said and retracted. This end is near crowd. It's not unique to our time. It has existed in every century since and including the first. A recent book called AD 1000, Living on the Brink of the Apocalypse, shows that the end is near mentality was around at the end of the first millennium in AD 1000. Here's the book. Let me just read you just the opening sentence. On the last day of the year 999, according to an ancient chronicle, the old Basilica of St. Peter's at Rome was thronged with a mass of weeping and trembling worshipers awaiting the end of the world. And it goes on to describe what happened there. That's 1,000 years ago. Think it'll be happening again if we're here in AD 3000? Yeah, I do. Now, the purpose of this study is not to expose premillennialism, but we need to say a few things about it. There's so many today that adopt that view, that misguided view. Does it make any difference what we believe about premillennialism? Is it just a matter of opinion? Well, if you listen to Carol Osborne, the Carmichael Distinguished Professor of New Testament at ACU, the answer you'll get is yes, it is. In his book, The Peaceable Kingdom, he says it's just a matter of opinion. And you know what else he puts on that list of matters of opinion? Whether baptism is for the remission of sins or because of the remission of sins. Well, the Carmichael Distinguished Professor of New Testament from ACU is dead wrong. And rather than let me tell you how important premillennialism is and our view of it is, let me let the leading premillennialist tell you how important it is. John Woolward is the leading premillennialist. I think he passed away a few years ago, so I guess he is no longer a premillennialist. But at the time he wrote it, he was the leading premillennialist. And here's what he said about the importance of it. If premillennialism is only a dispute about what will happen in a future age, which is quite removed from the present issue, well, that's one thing. If, however, premillennialism is a system of interpretation which involves the meaning and significance of the entire Bible, defines the meaning and course of the present age, determines the present purpose of God, gives both material and method to theology, that is something else. And that's what he believes. It is the growing realization that premillennialism is more than a dispute about Revelation 20. It is not too much to say that millennialism is a determining factor in biblical interpretation of comparable importance to the doctrines of verbal inspiration, the deity of Christ, the substitutionary atonement, and bodily resurrection. Just a matter of opinion? Not according to them. According to them, it determines how you read the entire Bible. It's on par with the resurrection. So with all due respect, which isn't much, to the Carmichael Distinguished Professor of New Testament at ACU, he needs to look at what they're saying about it. It does make a difference what we believe about this subject. The premillennialist doctrine has consequences that run counter to the very heart of the gospel. You know, we owe a great debt to Foy Wallace for keeping premillennialism out of the Lord's church. Foy Wallace, who was then editor of the Gospel Advocate, debated Charles Neal, who was then minister of the Main Street Church of Christ in Winchester, Kentucky. In 1933, they had a debate on this subject about the thousand-year reign. And Foy Wallace, in that debate, was largely responsible for keeping that false doctrine from infiltrating the church. You know, we have an anti-debate attitude today. We might offend somebody by our knowledge, by our conviction. But I'm certainly glad Foy Wallace did not have that attitude. You know, Foy Wallace and the people of his generation were more interested in pulling perishing people aboard the boat than they were in rocking that boat. And I, for one, am thankful that they had that attitude and that conviction. Next week, we're going to start by looking at these aspects of premillennialism that run counter to the gospel. We're going to look at a few other approaches to this book, and we're going to get to verse 1 next week, God willing. Thank you very much for your attention here today.